Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to the artist and architect Neil Bernstein. Right now, I would like to welcome, joining us by telephone, Jonathan Mooney. He's the author of the book, The Short Bus, A Journey Beyond Normal. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So the basis of your story is that you were, during elementary school, put in special education classes. First of all, what were the so-called disabilities that landed you there?
Yeah, I was labeled learning disabled in fourth grade, labeled ADHD, which stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, in fifth grade. Dropped out of school for a year in sixth grade. I didn't learn to read until I was 12 years old. But I really like the way you phrased that question, because so-called disability is exactly kind of how I see things now. Dyslexia, ADHD are really just cognitive differences, and in the right environment, they're not deficits or disorders. They actually can be gifts, but that's not what I was told as a kid.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's one of the many things that's so interesting about this book. I mean, you write about the diagnosis of learning disability, and that's a loaded label, and it follows a lot of even worse labels historically, like word blindness. So tell us what happens when the medical model of illness, like you have an illness and it needs a cure, is used to categorize and to treat students like you.
Well, first, we should understand that I think we're at a moment in human history in which we're applying that medical model, which you rightly labeled as a pathological model, essentially, to the most number of people in human history. I mean, if you think about the way that we're expanding the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, we're including all these different ways to be sick. And essentially what that does is it dehumanizes a student, a young person, or just a human being in general. It looks at somebody through the lens of what's wrong, not what's right. It leads to a series of treatments opposed to modifications to the environment. And fundamentally, it blinds us to the reality that what disables most people with cognitive and physical differences is nothing inside of themselves, but the way that they're treated. Said differently, you know, I'm dyslexic, but dyslexia was not my disability. My disability was dysteachia, you know. My disability was being told I was stupid because I learned differently.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a – I mean, one of the great things about your book is I feel like it's really liberating to people, even who didn't go through what you went through, because you deeply question, and it's in the title of the book, you deeply question the word normal. So, like, what – normal seems like this method of thought control that happens to most of us, even if we aren't conscious of it. You were told throughout your schooling, try to act normal. How does our society construct normal, and how did you interpret that as a young person?
Well, I think normal, for the most part, is a sort of upper-middle-class male normal, you know. I mean, that's the type of human being that's an able-bodied, for that matter, an able-mind. That's the type of human being that's presented to us as the acceptable or archetyped or normate, for lack of a better word. But as you said, normal really is a fiction. It's an artifice, you know. It's kind of like a horizon, you know. As you try to be normal, as you try to make other people be normal, it just gets further and further away from you. It disappears. It doesn't really exist. But it is a tyrannical idea. I think normalcy is really present in our educational policy. Look no further than No Child Left Behind. You know, this idea of standardized education. I think it's really present in the history of our public policy. Most of us don't realize that in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, you could be forcibly sterilized by the U.S. government if you were deemed abnormal in the American eugenics movement. So it has a real dangerous, dangerous history and past, and I think it has a dangerous present. But there's hope in understanding that it's a fiction or an artifice, because if normal is whatever we make it, we can make it something different.
This whole eugenics piece is absolutely terrifying, and it's, you know, tell us more about that. And even today, where they don't, I don't know, I mean, are they sterilizing people today for being abnormal in various ways?
Well, they're not sterilizing people per se, but everyone should really understand that a stated goal of the emerging genetic industry is essentially a eugenic goal. You know, there are stated reputable scientists out there who claim to want to cure Down syndrome. Well, there's only one way to cure Down syndrome. That's to no longer have people with Down syndrome, right? There are genetic tests out there to tell you whether or not a fetus may have brown-eyed or blue eyes. You know, the next step for that is, are they dyslexic? Are they ADHD? So I definitely think that while the bad old days of forced sterilization are behind us in most circles, there is a very present, very public, and frankly not very fringe movement out there to rid the world of cognitive and physical differences. I think, and this is to paraphrase something that was written about in the New York Times op-ed section some time ago, that we are entering a postmodern or 21st century eugenics movement in the form of genetic testing.
We're talking to Jonathan Mooney. There's a very poignant section in the book about a woman who had a child with Down syndrome, and she almost lost the child on the operating table when the child was 2 years old, and they were grieving, and then the child lived. And I think you asked her, what would it be like if you didn't have this, you know, what would life be like without this child? And she said something about the rainforest and biodiversity. And I was wondering, and it, which kind of connects with what you're saying right now, there is this human diversity that we have, and it's hard to know really what would be lost, but we're pretty sure something would be lost if we didn't have that diversity.
Yeah, the argument, and then the woman you're referring to, her name is Candy Bassford, and they live in rural Seaman, Ohio, on a farm, and their daughter, Katie, has Down syndrome, and rightfully paraphrased that they almost lost her daughter as they were correcting a congenital heart defect. And I, being somebody who doesn't, or at the time of the book, didn't know many people with Down syndrome. I, being somebody who really was trying to be normal my whole life, that's my story in the book. I'm trying to be normal because I was told I was abnormal. I sort of flippantly looked at Candy and said, you know, how would the world be different if your daughter didn't exist? You know, and what she forced me to do is to draw that biodiversity parallel. And there is a concept in the environmental justice and rights movement that biodiversity, diversity of species, contributes to the health of a population or ecosystem. And Candy was making the same analogy to human beings, that we're all interconnected. You know, there's this archetype of the striving American who's independent. And most people in the disability rights movement want to jettison that and want to say, you know what, we're not independent, we're interdependent. So my well-being as a human being is intrinsically tied, interconnected to Katie's well-being, to Candy's well-being. And it is like a rainforest. Every single part plays its role. Its role may be subtle. Its role may not be quantifiable, but its role matters. And there's an intrinsic human dignity to every single life.
And in the example of the girl with Down syndrome, I mean, you make it so clear how this girl, this young woman, at the point where you met her, generated joy and innocence, and that had an effect on other people in a way that is impossible to quantify, but it's very real.
You know, my day ended on the farm with Candy and Katie and myself and my sister all on a big trampoline. And as we all bounced on this trampoline, there was a moment in which we sort of fell into an interdependent rhythm, each of us kind of bouncing at our own time. But anyone who's ever bounced on a trampoline realizes that if you bounce in sync with somebody else, you get thrown up higher than you could ever go on your own, right?
Yeah, that's a great metaphor in that
and
section.
And that's how the day ended. The day ended with me being thrown up higher than I could ever go on my own as a result of Katie, as a result of Candy, as a result of a different way of being.
I feel like the shame and the anxiety that you experienced are shared by so many people who aren't necessarily in special ed, but who don't conform to society's narrow definitions of normality, whether that be, you know, sexual non-normality or employment possibilities or whatever, you know, whatever your thing is. And one really obvious and simple thing is that a lot of people in this society are, you know, are punished for things that would in other cases, in other situations, really be an advantage. For example, not being able to sit at a desk for a long time.
Yeah.
We're punished for that. One can imagine a lot of contexts in which that would be considered a strength.
Yeah, you know, you go to Wall Street and they call that same trait multitasking. You know what I mean?
Right.
Anyone who cares about American education really has to look deeply into the reality that school often disempowers a lot of human traits that make people successful human beings that matter, that contribute to the world. It's a paradox, you know, age-old cliche that the most interesting adult comes from the most difficult child. You know, there is this socializing bent to school and to our institutions that wants to beat out those differences, when you're exactly right. You know, things that we call deficits or disorders in a school or work context can often, in a personal or employment context, really be strengths, gifts, and talents. I'll give you an example of that. I was told by the dean of the Rhode Island School of Design, RISD is the number one art school in America. I was told by that dean that almost half of their student body is dyslexic, right? There's a paradox. Creativity, visual thinking often comes hand in hand with these so-called differences or disorders.
And as you say, although it's hard to really point to any major differences in brains between people who have so-called learning disabilities and everybody else, there is a more developed right brain in a lot of people who have learning disabilities, but also a lot of people who are artists.
Yeah, that's right. And again, it's this constant line between are we pathologizing the artist brain by calling it learning disabled, or are we acknowledging that often creativity comes with a learning disability? But either way you cut it linguistically, the bottom line is that when you look at brain scans of creative individuals, when you look at brain scans of dyslexic individuals, you'll see an overdeveloped right hemisphere, which is the part of the brain responsible for processing visual thought, essentially. Often, you'll see a less developed left hemisphere of the brain, which is responsible for written language. And the interesting thing for me, to ground this in, a non-deficit model, is that overdeveloped right brain is an intrinsic result of the underdeveloped left brain. The brain grows larger in other areas in response to those deficits. So in some respects, again, whether you want to call it the creative brain or the LD brain, it doesn't matter how we label it. It really is an embodiment of cognitive diversity that's important to the well-being of society.
We're talking to Jonathan Mooney. One other thing that's amazing is just how much hostility there is toward people who are supposedly abnormal. And you know, if you're in special ed as a child, you know it very well. But even as an adult, we can talk about this in a moment, but you actually bought a short bus, you know, hence the name of the book, and you were driving it down the road, and you had furious epithets yelled at you from other cars. What is this hostility all about?
Well, I think we're all told, and again, this for me, it ain't about special ed or not special ed. It ain't about dyslexia, ADD. You know, we're all told that we should strive for somebody else's ideal of who we should be. And when you capitulate to that message, you know, when you give up yourself to that message, whether it be a self that wanted to be an artist and you went to be a banker instead, whether it be a self that bought into the low expectations that others set for you, when you give up to that and then you see somebody who hasn't given up to that message of be normal, when you see somebody who has willfully defied it, or you see somebody who has no option to be normal, somebody with a physical difference that you can see, it makes you angry. It makes you jealous in some respect. You know, you say to yourself, well, I've given up so much. Why don't they do the same? So I do think that we greet difference with hostility. But underneath that hostility, in some respects, is envy and is a feeling of, I wish I could live outside the lines.
That's a very interesting interpretation. I mean, I was reading the book, and I was wondering if the same hostility directed toward toward you and so many others was the same hostility that's directed toward foreigners who are also supposedly different in our book.
Of course, it is. It is at the core of the marginalization of people with disabilities or cognitive differences is a fear of the other, which is at the core of the marginalization of immigrants, of foreigners, of people of different sexualities. I mean, look at their irrational response to gay marriage. I mean, I really consider it to be an irrational, deep-seated hostility to two people who want to enter a legally binding marriage. That comes from not any rational thought around public policy or degrading marriage. That comes from a deep-seated desire for people to be normal and a fear of the other.
Another thing I got from your book is that the situation of special ed kids is made really a lot worse by the fact that we don't have that much of an artistic culture in which to contain our humanity and our creativity. Like, in other places, in other countries, there are traditions that are mainstream, that are normal, of drumming and music and dancing and art and theater. Those are part of normal life, and the kids would have a place to put these things and really be fully human in a way that's very natural and, it has a long past. Whereas here, it seems like the only alternative to, to what you encounter in school as an outlet seems to be sports.
I think that's a brilliant insight. First thing to be cut in a struggling inner city school is art programming. We all know that, The thing that often receives the most per capita funding out of a school district that's extracurricular is an athletic team. There are very few accepted alternatives to the traditional academic college route, and I would extend it. I would extend it beyond creativity and the access to authentic creative ways to be a human being. But there's no acknowledgement that maybe college isn't somebody's dream for themselves. Maybe somebody's dream for themselves is to build things with their hands. There's no appreciation of craft anymore. There's no apprenticeship anymore. There's one road. And I think this is actually getting worse, which is a paradox, We know so much about human diversity, and yet in education we're moving towards standardization. There's one road. It's an academic road that leads to higher education. And if you choose a different path at any point, somehow that's a failure on you, on your family. And I think moving forward, anyone who cares about deep, flourishing human culture needs to challenge that myth that the only successful life is a life that leads to higher education.
We're talking to Jonathan Mooney. It seems like there's also a link between your critique of, the way special ed kids are treated and the cultural critique of the military-industrial society in which we live, and the sort of, as you said, the anti-gay marriage bias and all of that. Have you talked to other social critics about the kind of common ground that you have?
There's an interesting irony in the sort of critical disability theory movement. And unfortunately, and again, I think this goes to that really deep-seated fear of the person with a disability as embodying the other who is disconnected from human experience. There's a real reluctance on the part of whether it be the New Left or whether it be critical race theorists or whether it be critical gender theorists to embrace critical disability theory. And I think that is unfortunate, but there's a story that moves in sort of this theoretical world in which somebody wanting to study critical disability theory approached Judith Butler, who is sort of rightfully so one of the foremost leaders in this sort of work, and she wanted nothing to do with critical disability theory. So that's a challenge for people in progressive circles who see themselves as progressive or critical or engaged in a critique of culture, to make sure that within that critique there's room for people who fall on the other side of normal when it comes to their bodies and minds.
It's interesting because when you say that, I'm thinking some of these people have probably fought pretty hard to get into college and graduate school, and they don't necessarily want to think about you know, about the people who maybe didn't make it the way they did. And I think it's so, you know, you were a special ed kid, then you went on to study literature at Brown University, you graduated with honors, but you didn't leave your past behind. I mean, instead you wrote about it, and for this book you bought an actual short bus and drove it around the country.
Yeah, if anything, this was a journey that may have begun as trying to leave my past behind, but it's a journey that ended up with a celebration of my past in some ways. You know, I really did start this trip, and it's a trip that's documented in the book. It took place in a short school bus converted to an RV, 35,000 miles, 4 months, all around America. And I really thought that at the end of that journey, I would get rid of the bus, you know, like leave it in front of my school, you know, realize that you know, I wasn't that kid anymore. But what I realized at the end of the journey was there was never anything wrong with that kid who was made to ride that bus. What was wrong was with the culture that dehumanized a difference, a culture that worships at the feet of normalcy at the expense of any other way to live a life.
And the, you know, the deficit, the detriments of that, the social detriments of that are so huge, because a person who is struggling to be normal, their creativity is automatically suppressed. You can't be creative when you're struggling to be normal.
I don't think you can live your life broadly defined, and creativity is a part of creating a life. You can't do that when you're struggling to be normal. Those two are opposed ideas. Creating an authentic life requires that one define normalcy in some ways, and it requires that one pursue not normal as a way to live, but the concept of being a singular individual, which is a term that the famous photographer Diane Arbus used to describe her life, that she wanted to be a singular individual, which is value neutral, not normal, not abnormal, not a freak, not different, but a singular human being.
And, you know, and at the same time, to connect to others who are out of the norm as you are. I mean, that's an important piece as well, and that's something that you did on this trip.
I think it's only in community, this is paradoxically, where one really lives an individual life. And that was brought home by Candy and Katie, you know, that challenge to reject the independence model and adopt an interdependence model. That was driven home in every stop on this bus. You know, there's a difference between community knowledge and institutional knowledge. Institutional knowledge is the frame of mind and the frame that births this medical model of labels, diagnoses, and treatment. Because when you're immersed in an institution, you're seen through that lens of what's your category, and then you're treated as such. But when you're in a community, when you're in interdependent relationships with other human beings, labels are irrelevant. You know, John is just John, or Katie's just Katie. She's not somebody with Down syndrome.
As the laws have changed, and there have been new laws that, for example, have required public school systems to give everybody an education, has there been social progress and awareness of the kind that you are hoping for and that you are, I think, trying to foster by writing this book?
Well, there's no question that laws like the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, passed in 1974, and the Americans with Disabilities Act, passed in 1992, really are watershed moments in the history of the civil rights of people with disabilities. There's no question about that. Anyone that sees those laws through too much of a theoretical lens and not a pragmatic lens is really doing a disservice to the civil rights of people with disabilities. Now, with that said, both of those pieces of legislation are enacted in spirit but not followed in letter, if that makes sense. You know, they're things that are not implemented to their full intent. Within our culture, the discrimination of people with disabilities, I would argue, is right up there with any other minority group. They're incarcerated at greater rates. They live in poverty at the greatest rates out of any minority group in our culture. So while our law laws are in place, why the spirit of those laws are revolutionary, the implementation and the practice has a long, long way to go.
You ended up the book going to Burning Man. And tell us, first of all, for those who don't know what that is, what is Burning Man and why did you decide you wanted to go there?
You've been there, Mary?
I have not.
Okay, get there if you can. Burning Man is hard to define, so I'll just give everyone the facts. Burning Man occurs at the end of August every year, in which 40,000 people from all around the world journey to the Black Rock Desert, which is in Nevada, to build a community that really has no rules other than creativity, essentially. It is many things, and the hard thing about Burning Man is if 40,000 people come to the event, it's 40,000 different events. But for me, it really embodied a place in which the challenge was to be singular. And the challenge was a question, which is when there are no mandates of be normal, who are you? And that was a very personal question. Who are you, Jonathan? And for me, it was a place in which I had to deal and struggle with that very difficult question. When you're not being told who you are, who are you? And every person should struggle with that question. Burning Man's not a necessity to struggle with that question. It's just a means, a platform to struggle with that question. But for me, it was a profound opportunity to figure out who I was when I wasn't being told who I should be.
And how'd that go for you?
You know, it was tremendously healing. Burning Man, as I said, has no rules, but it does have a structure. In the middle of this city of 40,000 people in the desert, there's a giant man who's built out of wood. And at the end of the week, the man is burned, hence Burning Man. And obviously, that has a real historic significance. The king was burned in effigy in the Middle Ages. It's a symbol of whatever authority figure in your life being burned to the ground. But also, it's a regenerative thing. You know, from fire, birth new life. So the idea is everyone brings something to burn at the end of the week. And I had brought with me these pictures that I had of me from school when I was the special ed, you know, short bus rider kid. And I had intended to burn those pictures with the idea of letting go of that kid or no longer being that person. And at the burn, what I realized is I couldn't burn that kid. You know, there was nothing ever wrong with that kid. So I kept those pictures. And that was a really healing moment for me.
Jonathan, I hope you come to Santa Fe sometime because in the fall we have an event called Fiesta in which we publicly burn a giant effigy called Zozobra, which is also called Old Man Gloom. And everybody goes and screams and yells and gets their yayas out and it burns and it has a maybe some, I don't know how similar and different it is to Burning Man, but it sounds like there's some similarities.
Well, I think the spirit and the spirit of that event, but also the spirit of Santa Fe, are exactly the same. The commitment to having a multifaceted and broad definition of what a meaningful human life is, the acceptance of creativity as an essential, not marginal, but essential part of a meaningful human life. Hey, that's that festival, that's Burning Man, and that's Santa Fe, and I'd be there with bells on.
Well, we do hope you come sometime. Jonathan Mooney is the author of the book, The Short Bus, A Journey Beyond Normal. And your website is...
JonathanMooney.com has a lecture schedule and an email if anyone wants to write and say hello.
Jonathan Mooney, and it's spelled M-O-O-N-E-Y. Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it was really a pleasure. Take care.
You too. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Richard Jennings. He is a designer of sustainable water systems. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
It's great
to see you again.
It's good to see you. It's great to have you here. Now, you have been working on not only sustainable water systems, but what you call biomimetic metaphors for water and nutrient recycling. That means that you take man-made systems, like water systems, that people invented, and base them on human and animal, digestive processes?
On nature, basically, on natural processes and systems.
So how does that work? How did you start thinking about it that way?
Actually, this got started four some years ago, whenever Helen and Newton Harrison were here. at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and I worked with them on their exhibit. And one of the
it was a good 3 years ago, I think.
Yeah. One of the things that we talked about in many, many conversations was analog systems, analog forests, analog lagoons, analog soils, things where you take a system and build it to be an analog of the real thing, but it's completely man-made.
And so what are some examples of that?
Well, what I'm doing is also relating to biomimicry, the work of Janine Benyus and her writings. The idea is to take human-created systems and try to make them function like a natural system, to be eventually self-organizing and self-maintaining, as opposed to needing constant inputs of money, energy, water, et cetera, et cetera. So
that's a tall order for things that are made of, you know, pipes and screws and stuff like that.
Well, one of our principles is that everything has to, a good system is biologically complex and mechanically simple. So the less pipes and screws, the better in the long run. We use them, but we use them judiciously, you could say, so that everything we do has a reason, and it's hopefully the cheapest and simplest and most robust way of doing things. The first kind of metaphor that I came up with was everyone uses the toilet and then the material goes away, but where is away and why do we want it to go away? Basically, there's a book called Future Fertility by John Beebe, and one of his premises is that what goes out one end came in the other end, and it's essentially the same stuff with slightly different characteristics.
So, well, hang on a second. What you eat is full of nutrients, and what you get rid of
is full of nutrients.
Oh, I thought you'd absorb most of the nutrients.
No, you absorb some of them, but then what do you do? If you absorb them and it never comes back out, you'd explode, right? I mean, you burn the starches and sugars as a metabolic processes. The protein makes your body, and then it breaks down and it goes back in your urine. Your feces contains a lot of the undigested stuff. And in that is the mineral content of what you ate. So what that means is that what goes in one end comes out the other end and has the same nutrients pretty much that can sustain you if you transform them back into something you want to eat.
And so that is obviously, on the face of it, E. coli heavy, stinky process. What is the cycle like from, essentially what goes into the toilet to something useful for humans?
Okay, well, first thing we did is we looked at the digestive process, and you have the small intestine, the large intestine, and then we looked at the septic tank as the square intestine, the third stage of digestion. And in that process, you can pretty much eat all the things that you don't want, or the bugs, the bacteria will eat it, and transform it into a clear liquid, which is metabolized partly by what we call the lungs of our system, which is a small aquarium-sized air pump that uses 25 watts of electricity. So now we're respirating and we're metabolizing and digesting in the square intestine.
So the square intestine is filled with a particular type of insect or creature?
Well, I say bugs are actually microorganisms.
Okay.
They're mostly lactobacillus species that were collected by the inventor of the system from underneath redwoods. And the reason that that's important is because they've lived in and evolved in nature and are able to eat a lot of things, including breaking down cellulose in toilet paper, things like that. They're pretty hungry and robust bugs.
And so what goes into the square intestine is from your toilet. What comes out is what?
That's what we call blood. Blood for the earth, right? It's got oxygen and it's got nutrients and it's a clear liquid. It doesn't have the iron, so it's not red. But in essence, it's blood for the earth. And with a pump tank that distributes it, we then are re-nourishing the earth with the same nutrients that came from the earth to nourish us.
And in that, you can then grow food. Flowers or anything?
Food, fiber, fuel, beauty is important, habitat, shade, windbreak, all the things that we really need in semi-arid areas.
I think there has been so much hesitation resistance to using human waste in useful ways because of E. coli, because of bacteria, and not to mention the things like antibiotics and prescription drugs and all the things that our sewer systems are dealing with. How is that dealt with in your system?
Well, one way is I don't eat that stuff. So that's a personal choice that, you know, you can eat organic food and you can eat and not dose yourself with a lot of chemicals. And if you don't use them, you don't have to get rid of them. So on one level, that's one way to do it. On the other level, there's what's called retention time in the soil. Most things are food for some organism if they have enough time to get at them and eat them. So E. coli is a food when it gets in the soil.
Yeah, that if you eat the most organic diet in the world, the E. coli is still there.
Well, yeah, there's always bacteria, viruses, all kinds of things. But they'll either be absorbed or eaten in a healthy biological system.
And so how do you, as master of the sustainable water system, make sure that all these processes are working properly, that you have enough microorganisms, that these processes are continuing as they should?
Well, you can lift the tank, the lid of the septic tank, and take a whiff. If it smells good, it's working. It's that simple. And if the plants are growing, it's working. It's really, natural systems are pretty much self-organizing if you get them set up right, and they take care of themselves.
And so you don't have to keep on adding lactobacilli and stuff like that?
For the way our company does it, we check the system twice a year and make sure that, like a pump didn't die or something. Other than that, no, there's really nothing to do except flush your toilet and watch your plants grow.
Now, does this rely on what people call a composting toilet? No, that's a different thing.
No, this is a different thing. That the composting toilet doesn't use any liquid.
Right.
And this is based on the idea that pretty much everyone in this society wants a flush toilet. So why not turn it into a system to distribute moisture and nutrients instead of a polluter?
Now, is this legal in the city of Santa Fe or the county?
Yeah. I had probably a history of being a little too experimental in my early days, but now everything we do is permitted. So they're all legal, they're all permitted, they're all inspected. So, yes, you can do it anywhere.
We're talking to Richard Jennings, designer of sustainable water systems. How much room, how much actual land minimum does a household need to have a system like this that functions?
I've got a 900-foot square orchard, and that's pretty much enough. It's partly how intensely you want to distribute and store your nutrients and your moisture. The other metaphor that I use is the analog riparian area.
Right.
And this is based on the fact that in semi-arid areas, if you look around, you will find that most of our rivers and streams, our perennial flows, are really now in our sewers. They're not in the stream banks. They're in pipes underground.
That's a pretty amazing concept.
How I got that? I took a class of sixth graders out on a field trip to the Santa Fe River. And one of the things I do is we have scavenger hunts, which is kind of a way for them to learn about what's in the river, which was not water. It was like shopping carts and trash and things like that. And they'll have like a bingo card and they fill it out with what they found on their scavenger hunt. And one of the things they pointed out to me was, hey, there's no water. Would you bring us here? This isn't a river. And this was right upstream from the sewage treatment plant. And that's where our perennial flow is. It comes out the back of the sewage plant. There's always river running south of Rodeo Airport Road.
Through the sewage treatment plant.
Yeah.
And so that's, on the face of it, kind of a depressing thing. When you use that as a metaphor and you think of sewage as an analog to a river, how do you use that in a positive way?
Well, you have moisture and nutrients. So if obviously, the fishing and swimming and things are out, but what you are able to do is establish analog riparian areas, which is the stream bank, the moist area along a river, where biology is concentrated, where resources are concentrated. Because of the moisture and the nutrients, you have more plant life, you have an overstory, you have shade, you have a much denser habitation by birds, insects, small animals. You have a corridor for wildlife. You have a place for pollinators and beneficial insects. So I'm just dealing with what we got. You know, it's not as obviously as pleasant as a flowing river, but it's also distributed more widely throughout the community and can be used as a resource.
If a lot of people did this, would things like aquifer recharge happen in a more efficient way?
Depends on where you do it. A lot of this area does not recharge the aquifer. It's mostly along the mountain front and in arroyos and stream beds. So, yeah, there could be some. One of the things that we did with the Harrisons that I came up with was called Seeps and Springs, and it was a concept to treat our sewage on the way down to the plant with smaller package plants on the assumption that a lot of the sewers were failing. And in the course of replacing the pipes, why not put in small plants? Treat the sewage and then release it like seeps and springs into the river after it's been cleaned up. And as it turns out, I just read a book that I got a couple of days ago, and they're doing that in Barcelona, Spain.
Really?
They have wetlands all up and down this river that act as treatment and polishing, and then they have the amenities of a running river with clean water.
So the wetlands actually work as a sewage processing plant on some level?
If they're designed, there's treatment wetlands and then there's natural wetlands. This is a one that's engineered to do this, and there's pretreatment to take out the chunks before it gets there. So what you have is an effluent that the plants can finish off and take up the nutrients.
We're talking to Richard Jennings. Now, can this be implemented, for example, if you know, Santa Fe or some other community had the will to try to do things like this using natural analogs for their sewage on a mass scale? Is this something that could be, well, you talk about Barcelona, it can be implemented on a mass scale.
Yeah, Barcelona is a whole lot bigger than Santa Fe.
Yeah. When you bring this up, I mean, do you talk to people about it in public life? What do they say?
Well, one place that we talk about it, and I'll get a little plug in here on the Radio Cafe, is for the Semi-Arid Cafe, which is a informal group of professionals that meets once a month and discusses these things. That's where a lot of these discussions go on. Some of this came out of my head, but a lot of it came from collaborative discussions and trying to break each other's designs and looking for, you know, weaknesses in everybody's thought process.
Trying to break each other's designs, that's how all good science works, I suppose.
Well, yeah, as long as you don't have ego involved, so that what you're looking for is the best answers. And it started out, me and another associate, Reese Baker, came up with this about a year ago. And we called it Beertopia to start, but that wasn't a real good name for a professional group. So, and it had the wrong focus. So now it's a Semi-Arid Cafe. And if I could give an email.
Sure.
It's Dana, D-A-N-A-G, Simmons, S-I-M-M-O-N-S, @gmail.com.
Dana G. Simmons @gmail.com.
Yes, and if you send him an email and say, put me on this Semi-Arid Cafe list, he's like our webmeister savior, because neither Reese nor I can do this kind of stuff on a coherent basis, and Dana takes care of it for us. And there's engineers, there's lawyers, there's inventors, there's landscapers, there's architects.
Now, we talked about it. It's not really about recharging the aquifers, but is there a water conservation angle to it?
Yeah, sure. Think of El Dorado. So they use, depending on whose numbers you look at, anywhere from 25 to 50% of their water is used for watering, for landscape irrigation.
So
that's a diversion, right? You're taking that out of your drinking water stocks and putting on plants.
Right.
If you don't have to do that, you've eliminated the diversion, and there's where your water conservation comes from. You're using everything twice. You're using things that would normally be pollutants. You can look at the energy balance of diverting, cleaning, pumping, distributing the water, so you're conserving energy as well. Because anytime you use water, you use energy. Anytime you use energy, you use water.
So in a place like El Dorado or any neighborhood in Santa Fe, if a group of neighbors got together and wanted to do this, in theory, they could save a lot of money by doing it together.
That's our next step, is cluster systems, is to womp it up from what we know works on the individual level to large scale. And when you increase scale, you get economies of scale, which means it costs less per household or per person, and you get the benefits of the same type of system. So if you have 8 houses on a system, you'll have a slightly bigger treatment system, but nothing that big. You'll have 1 pump instead of 8 pumps. You'll have 1 brain instead of 8 brains. We have designer own controls, which are our biomimetic brains, basically. They make simple decisions about what they should do. So you'd have 1 brain, 1 pump, which is the heart, 1 set of lungs, et cetera, supporting 8 people or 8 households. And the whole idea is to make this as inexpensive and widely used as possible.
And in theory, for institutions like schools, it could work very well, where there's a whole lot of liquid going out, a whole lot of waste going out, but then there's also things like playing fields and open land around it.
Yeah, we got one at Monte del Sol that we
and it's up and running.
Built. It's up and running. Their garden to school program has been running on rainwater it's a combination rainwater and sewage treatment system with automatic transfers of liquids and stuff like that.
So this could really have a significant water saving and energy saving effect in a place like a desert place like Santa Fe.
Oh yeah, and the other thing about Monte del Sol is they have a weather station. And they have a lot of readouts, so they can do student-type science there. So it's a way for them to learn how to design, think, build, operate, and see things, you know, see their orchard grow, things like that.
Richard Jennings is a designer of sustainable water systems here in Santa Fe. If people want to reach you, how can they do so?
Probably www.earthrights.com.
Earthrights.com. Richard, thanks so much.
With a W.
Earthrights with a W. W-R-I-G-H-T-S. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks for your good work and service to the community.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.